You don't need to know.
I do if I'm hauling it, which I haven't even decided yet.
Orin fell silent for a moment. Then...
This is Engspice.
Zerid blew out a sigh. No wonder the job would wipe his slate clean. Chem-engineered spice was not only especially addictive, it also altered users' brain chemistry such that only more of the same brand of Engspice could satisfy their need. Mere spice would not do. Dealers called Engspice the leash because it gave them a monopoly over their users. They could charge a premium, and did.
We have a buyer on Coruscant whose supply is running low. He needs this order to get to Coruscant quickly. Empire or no empire, you know why.
Zerid did know why.
Because if the users can't get their brand of Engspice, they'll go through withdrawal. And if they get through that...
They break their addiction to the brand, and our buyer loses his market. His concern over this is great, understandably.
Which means the exchange got to name its price.
Which works well for you, Z-Man. Don't sound so contemptuous.
Zerid chewed the corner of his lip. He felt a bit nauseated. On the one hand, he could be free with just this run. On the other hand, he'd seen an Engspice den on Balmora once, while serving in the army. Not pretty.
No,
Zerid said. For strength, he stared through the cockpit canopy at Volta, where his daughter lived, and shook his head.
I can't do it. Spice is bad enough. Engspice is too much. I'll earn my way out of this some other way.
Orin's voice turned hard.
No, you won't. You can die trying to make this drop, or you can die not making this drop. Do you understand my meaning?
Zerid ground his teeth.
Yes, I understand it.
I'm glad. Look at it this way. If you make the drop, you're even with the exchange. Maybe you even walk away, huh? If you don't make the drop, you're dead, and who cares?
Orin chuckled at his own cleverness, and Zerid wished for nothing more than to choke the bastard.
Then I need more,
Zerid said. If he was going to get dirty, he wanted enough credits in hand to buy a shower for his conscience.
Not just a clean slate. I want 200,000 credits on top of wiping out the debt. And I want 100 of it paid before I land on Volta. Which means you've got a quarter of an hour.
Z-Man.
This is non-negotiable.
Ah, you need some play money, huh?
Something like that.
Very well. Done. The first 100 will hit your account before you touch down.
Zerid bit his lip in anger. He should have asked for more.
When do I go?
The cargo is en route to Volta now. And when I say it's time to go, you move your tail.
Fine.
Zerid drew a deep breath.
You done talking, Orin?
I'm done.
Then I've got one more thing.
What is it?
The more I come to know you, the more I want to shoot you in the face. Just so you heard it from me at least once. 200,000 or no 200,000.
This is why I like you, Z-Man. Put your ship down as Red Dwarf and follow the docking instructions. I will contact you when the cargo is ready.
You loading Fat Man? Or am I flying something else?
I don't know yet. Probably we'll load Fat Man in the usual way. Modified maintenance droid. You'll know when I know.
If it ain't Fat Man, make Kriffig sure it's something else fast.
I will be in touch.
Fine,
Zerid said. No, it wasn't fine. He closed the channel, sat back in his chair, and stared out into space. Darnalla dismissed Aaron and Sayo, presumably so she, Satil, and Senator Amriss could take private counsel with Master Zim. With nothing to do and nothing more to say, Aaron returned to her chambers to... To what? She did not know what to do. She felt as if she should be doing something, but she had no idea what. So she ate without tasting, paced the floor, and meditated, trying to keep the pain at bay by staying busy. When that did not work, she checked the holonet for news. Unsurprisingly, The reports were filled with breathless speculation about the Imperial attack on Coruscant and what it meant for the peace negotiations. She could not bear the sound of the newscasters, so she muted the vid screen. There was no footage of Coruscant post-attack, so Aaron assumed the Empire must have jammed communications. Instead, the footage showed old images of the Republic's capital. Millions of speeders, swoops, and air cars moved in organized lines above the landscape of Duracrete and Transparisteel. Thousands of pedestrians strode the autowalks and plazas. The image changed to a view of the Jedi Temple taken from an airborne recorder. Aaron could not take her eyes from the image. The towers, the tiered layers of the structure. Towering statues of old masters, lightsabers pointed skyward, lined the broad avenue that led to the enormous doors to the temple. She remembered the sense of wonder she'd felt walking under those statues for the first time, side by side with Master Zalo. She'd been a child, and the temple and the statues had seemed impossibly big.
"This will be your home now, Aaron,"
Master Zalo had said, and smiled at her in his way. She wondered how the temple looked now, after the attack. Wondered if it even still stood. She imagined Master Zalo, commanding the Jedi Knights and Padawans, fighting Sith warriors in the shadows of those statues, just as she had fought the Sith warrior in the midst of the Alderaanian statues. She imagined him falling, dying. Tears welled anew. She tried to fight them, but failed. She could not level out her emotional state, wasn't even sure she wanted to. The pain of Master Zalo's death was all she had left of him. A thought struck her, and the thought transformed into an urgent need. An idea rooted in her mind, in her gut, and she could not unseat it. She wanted to know the name and face of Master Zalo's murderer. She wanted to see him. She had to see him. And if she could see the Sith, learn his name, then she could avenge Master Zalo. The more she pondered the notion, the more needful it became. But she could learn nothing on Alderaan as part of a peace negotiation. She knew what Zim, Darnalla, and Amriss would decide, what they must decide. They would put up a show of negotiating, then they would accept whatever terms the Sith offered. They would betray the memory of Master Zalo, of all the Jedi who had fought and fallen at the temple. It was obscene, and Aaron would not be party to it. Unable to contain her emotion, she shouted a stream of expletives, one after another, a wide and long river of profanity, of the kind she had not uttered since her adolescence. Moments later, an urgent knock sounded on her door.
"Who is it?"
she called, her voice still rough and irritable.
"It is Sayo. Are you? Well, I heard..."
"It was the vid,"
she lied, and powered off the vid screen.
"I want to be alone now, Sayo."
A long silence, then...
"You don't have to carry this alone, Aaron."
But she did have to carry it alone. The memory of Master Zalo was her weight to bear.
"You know where to find me,"
Sayo said.
"Thank you,"
she said, too softly for him to hear. She passed the hours in solitude. Day gave way to night, and no word came from Master Darnalla or Satil. She tried to sleep, but failed. She dreaded what the morning would bring. She lay in her bed in darkness, staring up at the ceiling. Alderaan's moon, gibbous and hazy, rose and painted the room in lurid light. Everything looked washed out, ghostly, surreal. For a moment she let herself feel as if she'd stepped into a dream. How else could matters have transpired so? How else could the Jedi have failed so? Master Darnalla's voice replayed in her mind over and over.
"I fear we will have no choice."
The pain of the words came from the fact that they were correct. The Jedi could not sacrifice Coruscant. The Republic and the Jedi Council would accept a treaty. They had to. All that remained was to negotiate terms. Terms that must be favorable to the Empire. In the end, the Empire's betrayal, the Sith's betrayal, would be rewarded with a Jedi capitulation. While Aaron recognized the reasonableness of the course, she nevertheless could not shed the feeling that it was wrong. Master Darnalla was wrong. Senator Amriss was wrong. Such a thought had never entered her mind before. It, too, brought pain. Everything had changed for her. Her fists balled with anger and grief, and she felt more shouts creeping up her throat. Breathing deeply, regularly, she sought to quell her loss of control. She knew Master Zallo would not have approved it. But Master Zallo was dead, murdered by the Sith. And soon he would be failed by the Order, his memory murdered by political necessity. Her mind walked through memories of Master Zallo. Not of his teachings, but of his smiles. His stern but caring reprimands of her waywardness. The pride she knew he'd felt when she was promoted to Jedi Knight. Those were the things that had bonded them, not pedagogy. The hole that had opened in her when she'd felt his death yawned still. She feared she might drain away into it. She knew the name of the hole. Love. She'd loved Master Zallo. He'd been a father to her. She had never told him, and now she never could. Losing something she loved had ripped her open in a way she had not expected. The pain hurt. But the pain was right. The Order had wrought a galaxy in which good capitulated to evil, where human feelings, Aaron's feelings, were crushed under the weight of Jedi non-attachment. What good was any of it if it brought matters to this? Her racing thoughts lifted her from bed. She was too restless for sleep. She put her feet on the carpeted floor, hung her head, tried to gather the thoughts bouncing chaotically in her brain. She realized that she still wore her robes, not her nightclothes. She crossed the room and stepped through the sliding doors to her balcony. The brisk wind mussed her hair. The scent of wildflowers and loam saturated the air. Insects chirped. A night bird cooed. It would have been peaceful under other circumstances. 100 meters down, the Alderaanian landscape unrolled before her. A meadow of tall grasses, shrubs, and slim apo trees that whispered and swayed in the breeze. She could not see the walls of the compound through the vegetation. It was beautiful, Aaron allowed. Yet she still had the sense that she was standing at the scene of a crime. The cool night air and calm setting did nothing to assuage the feeling that the Jedi had failed catastrophically. She gripped the top of the balcony so tightly that it made her fingers ache. Beyond the compound, in the distance, the surface of a wide, winding river shimmered in the moonlight. The running lights from a few boats dotted its surface. She watched their slow, hypnotic traverse over the water. The sky, too, was dotted with traffic. She found it infuriating that life went on as it had for everyone else, while for her, everything had changed. She felt as if she had been hollowed out.
"Thinking of jumping?" a voice said, a gentle smile in the tone.
She started before placing the voice aside. For a moment, he had sounded exactly like Master Zallo. Sayo stood on the balcony of his own chambers 5 meters to her right. He had to have been there the whole time. Perhaps he could not sleep either.
"No," she said. "Just thinking."
His usual calm expression was marred by a furrowed brow and worried eyes.
"About Master Zallo?"
he asked. Hearing someone else speak her master's name at that moment pierced her. Emotion welled in her, put a fist in her throat. She nodded, unable to speak.
"I am sorry for you, Aaron. Master Zallo will be missed."
She found her voice.
"He was more to me than just a master."
He nodded as if he understood. But she suspected he did not. Not really.
"To speak of non-attachment, to understand it, that's one thing. But to practice it..."
He stared at her.
"That is another."
"Are you lecturing me, Sayo?"
"I am reminding you, Aaron. All Jedi must sacrifice. Sometimes we sacrifice the emotional bonds that usually link people one to another. Sometimes we sacrifice more, as did Master Zallo. That is the nature of our service. Don't lose sight of it in your grief."
She realized that there was more separating her from Sayo than 5 meters of space. Her grief was allowing her to see for the first time.
"You do not understand,"
she said. For a time he said nothing. Then,
"Maybe I don't, but I'm here if you need to talk. I am your friend, Aaron. I always will be."
"I know that."
He was silent for a moment, then stepped back from the ledge of his balcony.
"Good night, Aaron. I'll see you in the morning."
"Good night, Sayo."
He left her alone with her thoughts, with the night. Sacrifice, Sayo had said. Aaron had already sacrificed much in her life, and Master Zalo had sacrificed all. She did not turn from sacrifice, but sacrifice had to have meaning. And she saw now that it had all been for nothing. Always, she had quieted her needs, her desires, under the weight of sacrifice, non-attachment, service. But now her need was too great. She owed Master Zalo too much to let his death go unavenged. Darnalla and Zim and Amriss and the rest of them could accede to onerous Sith terms to save Coruscant. That was a political matter. Aaron's matter was personal, and she would not shirk it. She returned to her room and flicked on the vidscreen. More commentary on the attack. A Saurian pundit offering his analysis of how it changed the balance of power in the peace negotiations. Aaron watched the vids to distract her. Barely saw them. Vids.
Vids,
she said, sitting up. The temple surveillance system would have recorded the Sith attack. If she could get to it, she could see Master Zalo's murderer. Assuming the temple still stood. Assuming the recording had not been discovered and destroyed. Assuming the Jedi did not surrender Coruscant to the Empire. It should not come to that, Master Darnalla had said. Should not. Aaron would not leave her need to chance. Not this time. She was thinking of jumping after all. Having made the decision, she knew she had to act on it immediately, or let doubt assail her certainty. She rose, feeling light on her feet for the first time in hours. She gathered her pack, tightened her robes, and stepped back out onto the balcony. The wind had picked up. The leaves hissed in the breeze. The next step, once taken, was irrevocable. She knew that. She spared a glance at Sayo's room, saw it was dark. Heart racing, she turned and leapt into the open air, following her thoughts groundward, untethered from the order, from non-attachment, from everything save her need to right or wrong. Using the force to slow her descent, she hit the ground in a crouch and sped off. No one had seen her leave, and no one would mark her absence before dawn. She would be at her ship and gone well before that. She'd need to figure a way to get to Coruscant, and she had an idea of who could help her. She wanted those surveillance vids, and then she wanted to find the Sith who murdered Master Zalo. The Order might be forced to betray what it stood for, but Aaron would not betray the memory of her master.
Chapter 4. The rest of the Sith force had returned to the fleet, but Malgus lingered. He stood alone among the ruins of the Jedi Temple. He powered off his comlink, putting him out of touch with Imperial forces, and communed in solitude with the Force. Walking the perimeter of the ruins, he loitered over the destruction, pleased at his victory, but flat with the realization that he had defeated his enemy, and no obvious replacement was apparent. He longed for conflict. He knew this of himself. He needed conflict. There would be more battles with the Jedi and the Republic, of course. But with the capture and raising of Coruscant, the fall of the Republic was a certainty. Only a matter of time. Soon his Force vision would be realized. Then, what? He would have to trust that the Force would present him with another foe, another war worth fighting. Scaling a mound of rubble, he found a perch that offered an excellent view of the surrounding urbanscape. The cracked face of the statue of Odon Ur lay atop the mound beside him, eyeing him mournfully. There, astride the ruins of his enemy, Malgus waited for the Imperial fleet to begin the incineration of the planet. An hour passed by. Then another. And as twilight gave way to night, the number of Imperial ships prowling the sky over Coruscant began to thin rather than thicken. Bombers returned to their cruisers, and fighters took up not attack, but patrol formations. What was happening? The Imperial fleet did not have the resources to manage a long-term occupation of Coruscant. Imperial forces had to raise the planet and move on before Republic forces could gather for a counterattack. And yet, nothing was happening. Malgus did not understand. He activated his comlink and raised his cruiser, Valor.
Darth Malgus,
said his second-in-command, Commander Jard.
We've been unable to raise you for hours. I was concerned for your well-being. I just dispatched a transport to search for you at the temple.
What is happening, Jard? Where are the bombers? When will the planetary bombardment begin?
Jard stumbled over his reply.
M'lord, I... Darth Engril...
Malgus's hand squeezed the comlink as he surmised the meaning behind Jard's stuttering response.
Speak clearly, Commander.
It seems the peace negotiations are continuing on Alderaan, m'lord. Darth Engril has instructed all forces to stand down until matters there crystallize.
Malgus watched a patrol of Mark VI interceptors fly over.
Peace negotiations?
That is my understanding, Darth Malgus.
Malgus seethed, stared at a smoke plume thrown up by a burning skyrise.
Thank you, Jard.
Will you be returning to Valor, my lord?
No. But get that transport to me now. I require an audience with Darth Engril.
The terms of the negotiations prohibited either the Imperial or Republic delegations from posting external security around the High Council building and compound. Instead, both had their extended delegations posted in nearby cities. Moving with force-augmented speed, Aaron easily avoided the Alderaanian guards posted on the grounds of the compound. A canine with one of the guard teams must have caught her smell. It growled as she passed, but before the guards could turn on their infrared scanners, Aaron was already 100 meters away. She did not exit through any of the checkpoints. Instead, she picked her way among the gardens until she reached the compound's walls, veined in green creepers blooming with yellow and white flowers. Without slowing, she drew on the force, leapt into the air, and arced over the 5-meter wall. She hit the ground on the other side, free. To her surprise, she did not feel a pull to turn back. She took this as a sign that she had made the right decision. The High Council building perched atop a wooden hill. Winding roads, steams, and scenic footpaths led down the hill to a small resort town nestled at its foot. Lights from the town's buildings blinked through the streets and other foliage. The susurrus of traffic and city life carried up the hill. It was late, but not so late that she couldn't hail an air car taxi and get to the spaceport before her absence was noted. Without looking back, she sped off into the night. When she reached town, she located a line of automated aircar taxis parked outside an open-air eatery filled with young people. A Rhodian chef manned the central grill, his arms a whirl of cleavers and knives. The smell of roasted meat, smoke, and a spice she could not place filled the air. Music blared from speakers, the bass causing the ground to vibrate. She kept her hood drawn over her face and hopped into the first taxi in line. The anthropomorphic droid driver put an elbow on the seat and turned to face her. It wore a ridiculous cloth hat designed to make it look more human. Given her own fragile emotions, Aaron was pleased to have a droid driver. Droids were voids to her empathic sense.
Destination, please!
The Essene spaceport, she answered.
Very good, mistress.
The door of the taxi closed, the engine started, and the car climbed into the air. The town fell away underneath them. The droid's social programming kicked in, and it tried to make small talk designed to put a passenger at ease.
Are you from Alderaan, mistress?
No,
Aaron said.
Ah, then may I recommend that you try...
I have no need for conversation, she said. Please drive in silence.
Yes, mistress.
Once the taxi took position at commercial altitude and fell into a lane, the droid accelerated the taxi to a few hundred kilometers per hour. They'd make the spaceport in half an hour. She considered powering on the in-car vid screen, but decided against it. Instead, she looked out the window at other traffic, at the dark Alderaanian terrain.
Spaceport ahead, mistress!
Below and ahead, the Essene spaceport, one of many on Alderaan, came into view. Aaron could not have missed it. Its lights glowed like a galaxy. One of the larger structures on the planet, the spaceport was really a series of interconnected structures that straddled 50 square kilometers. The main hub of the port was a series of tiered, concentric arms that twisted around a core of mostly transparisteel, which locals called the bubble. It was very much a self-contained city, with its own hotels, restaurants, medical facilities, and security forces. From above, Aaron knew, the spaceport looked similar to a spiral-armed galaxy. It could dock several hundred ships at a time, from large super freighters on the lower-level cargo platforms to single-beam craft on the upper platforms. A tower for planetary control stuck out of the top of the bubble like a fat antenna. Due to the late hour, most of the upper docking platforms were dark, but the lower levels were bright and busy with activity. As Aaron watched, a large cargo freighter descended toward one of the lower platforms, while two others began their slow ascent out of dock and into the atmosphere. Shipping firms often did much of their work at night, when in-atmosphere traffic was reduced. Watching it all, Aaron was once more struck with the oddity of the fact that life for everyone else in the galaxy went on as it had, while the Republic itself was in grave danger. She wanted desperately to scream at all of them. What do you think is going to happen next? But instead she kept it inside, an emotional pressure that she thought must soon pop an artery. Dozens of speeders, swoops, and loader droids flew, buzzed, crawled, and rolled along the port's many docks and in the air around the landing platforms. Automated cranes lifted the huge shipping containers carried in the bays of freighters. Even from half a kilometer out, Aaron could see the lines of people and droids riding the autowalks and lifts within the spaceport's central bubble. The whole structure looked like an insect hive. A portion of the bubble, near the top, housed a luxury hotel. Each room featured a balcony that looked out on Alderaan's natural beauty. Seeing them, Aaron thought of her exchange with Sayo.
A Jedi must sacrifice, she said.
She was about to do exactly that.
I'm sorry, mistress,
said the droid.
Did you say something?
No.
What entrance, mistress?
I need to get to a level one, sublevel D.
Very good, mistress.
The air car descended from the traffic lane to stop at one of the entrances on level one of the spaceport. The droid offered his hand, which featured an integrated card scanner, and Aaron ran her cred card. The Order would be able to track her from its use, but she had no other way to pay. She stepped out of the air car and hurried through the automated doors of the port. Once inside, she moved rapidly, barely seeing the other sentients on the walkways and lifts. Conversation occurred around her, but lost in her thoughts, she heard it only as a distant buzz. Music blared from a darkened cantina. A young couple, a human man and a Saurian woman, walked arm in arm out of a restaurant, heads close together, laughing at some shared secret. Droids whirred past Aaron, carting cargo and luggage.
Pardon me, they said as they whizzed past.
Vid screens hung in strategic places throughout the facility. She eyed one, saw a view of Coruscant, which then cut to the High Council compound on Alderaan. She avoided looking at any other vids as she went. She kept her eyes focused on nothing, hoping that the late hour would spare her any contact with other members of the Jedi delegation who might be stationed at the spaceport. She feared the sound of their voices would pop the bubble of her emotional control. Hurrying along the corridors, lifts, and walks, she reached the level where she'd landed her Raven and let herself relax. She raised her wrist calmly to her mouth, thinking to hail T6, but a voice from behind called to her and shattered her calm.
Eren? Eren Lanier?
Her heart lurched as she turned to see Volan Sor, a fellow Jedi Knight, emerging from a nearby lift and hurrying to catch up with her. Volan's Padawan, a Rodian named Kivo, trailed behind him, a satellite in orbit around the planet of his master. Both wore their traditional robes. They wore their lightsabers openly outside their robes, as they would in a combat environment. She tensed. Perhaps Master Darnalla had noticed her absence and deduced her intent. Perhaps Volan and Kivo had come to stop her. She let her hand hover near the hilt of her lightsaber. By the time the transport set down near the temple, Malgus had followed enough communication chatter to understand what had occurred, and what he had learned only incensed him further. He bounded onto the transport and stood in the small rear cargo bay.
"Leave the bay open as you fly,"
he ordered the pilot over the transport's intercom.
"My lord?"
"Go to 100 meters up and circle. I want to see the surface."
"Yes, Darth Malgus." As the transport lifted him away from the ruins of the Jedi Temple, wind whipped around the bay and pawed at his cloak. He stood at the edge of the ramp and used the Force to anchor himself in place. From there, he surveyed Coruscant, the planet that should have been destroyed. Most of the urban scape was lit, so night did not hide the destruction. A haze of smoke hung like a funeral shroud over the still smoldering ruins. The air carried the faint, sickly, sweet tang of burned bodies and melted plastoid. He tried to guess the number of the dead. In the tens of thousands, certainly. 100,000? He could not know. He did know that it should have been billions. Shafts of steel stuck like bones out of piles of shattered duracrete. Here and there, droid-assisted excavation teams sifted through the rubble, seeking survivors or bodies. Frightened faces turned up to watch the transport pass.
"You should be dead,"
Malgus said to them.
"Not merely frightened."
Quadrant after quadrant of Coruscant had been reduced to rubble. But not enough of it. Most buildings still stood, and most of the planet's people still lived. The Republic had been wounded, but not killed. And there was nothing more dangerous than a wounded animal. Malgus had difficulty containing the anger he felt. His fist reflexively clenched and unclenched. He had been misled. Worse, he had been betrayed. A score of his warriors had died for no reason other than to strengthen the Empire's negotiating posture. Sirens screamed in the distance, barely audible over the wind. Far off, unarmed Republic medical ships whirred through the sky. Speeders and swoops dotted the air here and there, the traffic light and haphazard. Malgus had learned that Darth Angrel had dissolved the Senate and declared martial law. But with the planet pacified, Angrel had allowed rescuers to save whom they could. Malgus imagined that Angrel would soon allow free civilian movement. Life would start again on Coruscant. Malgus did not understand Angrel's thinking. No, he did not understand the Emperor's thinking, for it must have been the Emperor who had decided to spare Coruscant. Nothing was as it should be. Malgus had intended, had expected, to turn Coruscant into a cinder. He knew the Force intended him to topple the Republic and the corrupt Jedi who led it. His vision had shown him as much. Instead, the Emperor had given the Republic a slight burn and begun to negotiate. To negotiate. A squad of 10 Imperial fighters sped past, their wings reflecting the red glow of a nearby medical ship's sirens. Smoke plumes from several ongoing fires snaked into the sky. Malgus might have hoped that the Emperor planned to force the Republic to surrender Coruscant to the Empire. But he knew better. The fleet had temporarily secured the planet, but they did not have the forces to hold it for long. The planet was too big, the population too numerous, for the Imperial fleet to occupy it indefinitely. Even a formal surrender would not end the resistance of Coruscant's population, and an insurgency among a population so large would devour Imperial resources. No, they had to destroy it or return it. And it looked as if the Emperor had decided on the latter, using the threat of the former as leverage in negotiations. The pilot's voice sounded over the intercom.
"Shall I continue the flyover, my lord?"
"No. Take me to the Senate building. Notify Darth Angrel of our imminent arrival.
He had seen all he needed to see. Now he needed to hear an explanation.
Peace,
he said. The word a curse. Zerid finally noticed the ping from Volta's planetary control. He watched it blink, half dazed, having no idea how long they had been signaling him. He shook his head to clear up his thinking, called up the fake freighter registry Oren had told him to use, ran it through Fat Man's comp, and used it to auto-respond to the ping. In moments, he received approval to land and docking instructions.
Welcome to Volta, Red Dwarf, said the controller. Set down on Yinta Lake, landing pad 111B.
Zerid tried to let the heat of atmospheric entry burn away thoughts of Oren, of the exchange, of Angspice. He tried instead to focus only on the 100,000 credits that should be awaiting him, and what he could do with them. By the time the ship cleared the stratosphere and entered Volta's sky traffic, he had once more begun to distance himself from work and the persona that it necessitated. But stripping away the Vice Runner was getting harder to do all the time. The hole was getting too deep, the costume too sticky. He would be ashamed if his daughter ever learned how he earned a living. He gave Fat Man to the autopilot and went to the small room below the cockpit that he'd converted to his quarters. His time in the army had taught him the value of organization, and his room reflected it. His rack was neatly made, though no one ever saw it but him. His clothes hung neatly from a wall locker beside the viewport. He kept extra blasters of various makes stowed about the room, and a lockbox held enough extra charger packs to keep him firing for a standard year. The top of his small metalwork desk was clear, with nothing atop it but a port comp and a stack of fraudulent invoices. Integrated into the floor beside it was a hidden safe. He exposed it, input the combination, and opened it. Inside was a bare payment card with the mere handful of spare credits he'd been able to stash, and, more important, a small hollow of his daughter. Seeing the hollow summoned a smile. He picked it up. He always noticed the same three things about the image. Hera's long curly hair, her smile, as bright as a nova despite her handicap, and the wheelchair in which she sat. He could have chosen a hollow that didn't include the chair, but he hadn't. It pained him to see her in it, and it would continue to pain him until he got her out of it. And that was the point. The hollow reminded him of his purpose. He looked at the hollow before he went to sleep in his quarters, and he looked at it when he awakened. He hated the wheelchair. It was the sin he needed to expiate. Val and Era had been coming to see him on planetside leave. He'd still been in the army then. Val had been suffering dizzy spells, but she had insisted on coming anyway. And he, desperate to see his wife and daughter, had done nothing to discourage her. She'd had an episode while driving and careened into another air car. The accident had killed Val and left Era near death. Her legs had been crushed from the impact, and the doctors had been forced to remove them. He'd mustered out of the army to grieve for Val and take care of Era, not thinking much beyond, just getting through one day and then the next. He'd had no pension, no property, and soon learned that even with his piloting skills, he could not find legit work that paid anywhere near what he needed and was going to need. Not only had Era's immediate post-crash care resulted in enormous medical bills, but ongoing rehab cost just as much. Desperate, despondent, he'd taken a leap, jumping into the atmosphere and hoping he hit deep water. He called on some old acquaintances he'd known before his tour in the army, and they'd put him in contact with the exchange. When he'd heard their offer, he'd hopped on the treadmill, thinking he could make it work. His debts had only grown since. He'd gone into debt to an exchange-owned holding company for Fat Man, and he pretended to have a gambling problem against which he sometimes took additional loans. In truth, the credits from the loans went to Era's ongoing care.
but he was treading water there, too. He could barely make interest payments, and while he tried to keep his head above water, Era remained in a prehistoric, unpowered wheelchair. Zerit did not make enough to purchase her even a basic hover chair, much less the prosthetic legs she deserved. He'd once heard tell of technology in the Empire that could actually regrow limbs, but he refused to think much about it. If it existed somewhere, the cost would put it well beyond his means. He just wanted to get her a hover chair, or legs if he could hit a big job. She deserved at least that, and he planned to see to it. The Angspice run to Coruscant was the start, the turning point. The front-end money alone could get her a hover chair, and with his slate wiped clean afterward, he could actually start making real credits without all of it going to paying down debt. Credits for prosthetics. Credits for regrown legs, maybe. He'd see her run again. Play grav ball. He returned the hollow to the safe and stripped out of his work clothes, sloughing away Z-Man, the spice runner, to reveal Zerid, the father, and dropped them into a hamper. After he landed, he'd activate the small maintenance droid he kept aboard. It would clean and sweep the ship and launder his clothing. He threw on a pair of trousers, an undershirt, and his ablative armor vest, then took a collared shirt from its hanger and sniffed it. Smelled reasonably clean. He swapped out his hip holsters with their GH-44s for a single sling holster he'd wear under his jacket and fill with an E-11, then secured two E-9 blasters, one in an ankle holster, one in the small of his back. Era had never seen him holding a blaster since he had mustered out, and fate's willing, she never would. But Zerid never went anywhere unarmed. Before leaving his quarters, he sat at the port comp, logged in, and checked the balance in the dummy account he used with the exchange. And there it was, 100,000 credits, newly deposited.
Thank you, Warren.
He transferred the credits to an untraceable bearer card. It was more than he'd ever held in his hand before.
Vrath sat on one of the many metal benches found in Yinta Lake's spaceport on Volta. Droids sped past. Sentients went by in groups of two and three and four. Someone's voice blared over a loudspeaker. Like every spaceport on every planet in the galaxy, the place was abuzz with activity. Droids, holovids, vehicles, conversations. Vrath tuned it all out. A large vidscreen hanging from the ceiling showed the latest news on the right side and the latest ship arrivals and departures on the left. He watched only the arrivals. The board tracked every ship to which planetary control gave docking instructions, the scroll moving as rapidly as the activity in the port. Vrath was waiting for one name in particular. An exercise at will, the firing of certain neurons caused his artificial eyes to go to 3 times magnification. The words on the screen grew clearer. The Hutt's mole in the exchange had given Vrath a ship's name, which meant he had a pilot, which meant he could find the Angspice and keep it from ever getting to Coruscant. The Hutts wanted the addicts on Coruscant freed of their reliance on their competitor's Angspice, so they could be hooked on Hutt Angspice. A new market for Hutts, as Vrath understood matters. In truth, he found it surprising that the exchange had been able to find a pilot crazy enough to make a run to Coruscant, a world on Imperial lockdown. The exchange must have had a flyer with uncommon skill, or uncommon stupidity. The overhead vidscreen showed the same news footage that every vidscreen and holovid in the galaxy must have been showing. Another story on the peace negotiations on Alderaan. A Togruta female, Vrath knew she was a Jedi Master, but could not recall her name, was giving an interview. She looked stern, unbowed as she spoke. Vrath could not make out her words. The sound of engines and people made it impossible to hear. He could have activated the auditory implant in his right ear to pick up the vid sound, even through the noise, but he really did not care what the Jedi had to say. He did not care how the war between the Republic and Empire went, so long as he could thread the needle between them and make his credits. He hoped to retire soon, maybe to Alderaan. If he could take out the Angspice, the Hutts would compensate him well. Who knew? Maybe this would be his last job, after which he'd get drunk, fat, and old, in that order. He alternated his attention between the news and the arrivals board until he saw the name he was waiting for, Red Dwarf. He slung the satchel that held his equipment over his shoulder, stood, and walked to the Red Dwarf's landing pad. Lingering among the bustle, he watched unobtrusively as the beat-up freighter set down on the landing pad. He noted the modified engine housings. He suspected Fat Man was fast. He reached into his pack and took the nanodroid dispenser in hand. He ordinarily preferred to use an aerosolized version of the tracking nanos, but the port was too crowded for it. Ready, he waited. The Senate building came into view, a dome of transparisteel with a tower atop its center aimed like a knife blade at the sky. Most of the windows were dark. The transport headed for the landing pad atop the building. Halogens washed the roof in light. Malgus saw a squad of Imperial guards, gray as shadows in their full armor, and a single uniformed naval officer near the landing pad. The officer held his hand over his hat to keep the wind from blowing it off. Malgus did not wait for the ship to touch down. When the transport was still 2 meters up, he leapt out of the open cargo bay and landed before the officer, whose eyes went wide at the sight of Malgus's method of debarkation. The young officer, his gray uniform neatly pressed, his hair neatly combed under his hat, had probably not so much as fired a blaster in years. Malgus did not bother to disguise his contempt. He tolerated the officer and his ilk only because they provided necessary support to those who did the actual fighting for the Empire.
"Darth Malgus, welcome," the attaché said. "My name is Runeel, Darth Angrel."
"Speak only if you must, Runeel. Pleasantries annoy me at the best of times, and this is not the best of times."
Neil's mouth hung open for a moment, then closed.
"Excellent,"
Malgus said, as the transport put down and its weight vibrated the landing pad.
"Now, take me to Darth Angrel."
"Of course."
They walked across the roof to the turbo lift. Armored Imperial troops flanked the door to either side of it. Both saluted Malgus. Neil and Malgus rode the lift down several floors in silence. The doors opened to reveal a long, wide hallway lined with office doors to the right and left, and ending in a large pair of double doors on which were engraved the words, "The Office of the Chancellor of the Republic." Two more armed and armored Imperial soldiers stood guard at the doors. The arc-shaped reception desk immediately before the lift, presumably the domain of the Chancellor's secretary, sat empty, the secretary long gone. Rune indicated the Chancellor's office, but did not move to exit.
"Darth Angrel has commandeered the Chancellor's office. He is expecting you."
Malgus exited the lift and strode down the hall. The offices to either side of him stood empty, all of them showing signs of a hurried evacuation. Spilled cups of caff, papers lying loose on the carpeted floor, an overturned chair. Malgus imagined the shock the occupants must have felt as they watched Imperial forces pour out of the sky. He wondered what Angrel had done with the senators and their staffs. Some, he knew, had been killed in the initial attack. Others had probably been executed afterward. When he reached the end of the hall, the Imperial soldiers saluted, parted, and opened the doors for him. He stepped inside, and the doors closed behind him. Angrel sat at the desk of the Republic's Chancellor, on the far end of an expansive office. His dark hair, shot through with gray, was neatly combed, reminiscent of Rune Neil's. Elaborate embroidery decorated the color of his cloak. His angular, smooth-shaven face reminded Malgus of a hatchet. Art from various worlds hung on the walls or sat on display pillars. Bone carvings from Mon Calamari, an oil landscape painting from Alderaan, a wood sculpture of a creature Malgus could not identify, but that reminded him of one of the mythical Zillow beasts of Malastare. An opened bottle of blossom wine sat on Angrel's desk in a crystal decanter. Two chalices sat beside it, both half full with the rare, pale yellow spirit. Angrel knew that Malgus did not drink alcohol. Two large, high-backed leather chairs sat before the desk, their backs to the doorway. Anyone could have been seated in them. Behind the desk, a floor-to-ceiling transparisteel window looked out on the urban scape. Plumes of black smoke curled into a night sky, mostly empty of ships and underlit by the many fires burning across the planet. To Malgus, the black lines of smoke looked like the scribbles of giants. A maze of duricrete buildings extended out to the horizon.
"Darth Malgus,"
Angrel said, and gestured at one of the chairs.
"Please, sit."
Words burst from Malgus before he could stop them.
"We hold Coruscant in our fist and need only squeeze. Yet I understand that peace negotiations are continuing."
Angrel did not look surprised at the outburst. He sipped his blossom wine, put the chalice back down.
"Your understanding is correct."
"Why?"
Malgus put an accusation in the question.
"The Republic is on its knees before us. If we stab it, it dies."
"Using it as a lever in peace negotiations."
"Peace is for bureaucrats,"
Malgus blurted, too hard, too loud.
"It is not for warriors."
Still, Angrel's face held its calm.
"You question the wisdom of the Emperor?"
The words cooled Malgus's heat. He took hold of his temper.
"No, I do not question the Emperor."
"I'm pleased to hear it. Now sit, Malgus."
Angrel's tone left no doubt that the words were not a suggestion. Malgus picked his way through the artwork. Before he had gotten halfway across the office, Angrel said,
"Adras has beaten you here."
Malgus stopped.
"What?"
Adras rose from one of the chairs before the desk, revealing himself, and turned to face Malgus. He no longer wore his mask, and his face unmarred and handsome, like Master Zalo's, and with a neatly trimmed goatee, wore smugness with comfort. Malgus recalled the look on Zalo's face when the Jedi had died, and imagined replacing Adras's current expression with one that echoed Zalo's death grimace.
"Darth Malgus," Adras said, his false smile more sneer than anything. "I am sorry I did not announce myself before your outburst."
Malgus ignored Adras and addressed Angrel directly.
"Why is he here?"
Angrel smiled, all innocence.
"Lord Adras was giving me his complete report of the attack on the temple."
"His report?"
"Yes. He spoke highly of you, Darth Malgus."
Adras took the other chalice on Angrel's desk, sipped.
"He spoke highly of me."
Malgus did not play Sith politics well, but he suddenly felt as if he had walked into an ambush. He knew Adras was a favorite of Angrel's. Were they setting Malgus up? They certainly could use his condemnation of the peace talks against him. With effort, he got himself under control and sank into the seat beside Adras. Adras, too, sat. Malgus endeavored to choose his words with care.
"The attack on the temple could not have gone better. The plan I developed worked perfectly. The Jedi were caught completely unawares."
He turned to face Adras.
"But your report should have been approved by me before it came to Darth Angrel."
He turned back to Angrel.
"Apologies, my lord."
Angrel waved a hand dismissively.
"No apologies are necessary. I solicited his report directly."
Malgus did not know what to make of that, and did not like that he did not know.
"Directly? Why?"
"Do you believe that I owe you an explanation, Darth Malgus?"
Malgus had misstepped again.
"No, my lord."
"Nevertheless, I will give you one," Angrel said. "The reason is simple. I was unable to locate you."
"I powered down my comlink while..."
Adras interrupted him, and Malgus had to restrain the impulse to backhand him across the face. We assumed you to be checking on the well-being of your woman, Adras said.
We assumed,
Malgus said.
Do you presume to speak for Darth Angrel, Adras?
Of course not, Adras said, his tone infuriatingly unworried. But when we could not locate you, Darth Angrel asked me to speak for you. And there it was, unadulterated and out in the open. Not even Malgus could miss it. Adras had essentially admitted that he wished Malgus's spot in the hierarchy, and Angrel's participation suggested that he sanctioned the power grab. Malgus's voice went low and dangerous.
It will take more than words to speak for me, Adras.
No doubt, Adras said, and answered Malgus's stare with one of his own. His dark eyes did not quail before Malgus's anger. Angrel watched the exchange, then leaned back in his chair.
Where were you, Darth Malgus?
Malgus did not take his eyes from Adras.
Assessing the post-battle situation around the temple, my lord. Trying to understand.
He stopped himself. He almost said, trying to understand why the Empire has not raised Coruscant.
Trying to understand the planet-side situation more clearly.
I see, Angrel said. What of this woman Adras mentioned? I understand from Adras's report that she was a liability to you during the attack on the temple.
Malgus glared at Adras. Adras smiled behind the rim of the chalice as he drank his wine.
Adras is mistaken.
Is he? Then this woman isn't a liability to you. She is an alien, isn't she? A Twi'lek.
Adras sniffed with contempt, turned away from Malgus, and sipped his wine. The gestures perfectly capturing the Empire's view of aliens as, at best, second-class sentience. Angrel shared that view, and had just let Malgus know it.
She is,
Malgus answered.
I see,
Angrel said. Adras placed his wine chalice on Angrel's desk.
An excellent vintage, Darth Angrel, but right at the end of its cellar life.
I think so, too, Angrel said.
Let things linger around over long, and they can turn rancid.
Agreed,
Angrel said. Malgus missed nothing, but could say nothing. Adras snapped his fingers as if he had just remembered something.
Oh, Darth Malgus, I do regret that I had to refuse your woman treatment aboard Steadfast.
A tick caused Malgus's left eye to spasm. His fingers sank into the arms of the chair and pierced the leather.
You did what?
Priority is to be given to Imperial forces, Adras continued. Human forces. I'm sure you understand.
Malgus had had enough. To Angrel, he said,
What is this? What is happening here?
What do you mean?
Angrel asked.
The Twi'lek woman is planet-side, Adras said, as if no one else had spoken. I'm sure the care she receives will be adequate.
I mean, what is happening here, now, in this room? What is your purpose in this, Angrel?
Angrel's expression hardened, and he set down his glass with an audible clink.
My purpose?
Who is this woman to you, Darth Malgus?
Adras pressed.
Her presence at the battle for the Jedi Temple caused you to make mistakes.
Passions can lead to mistakes, Angrel said.
Passions are power,
Malgus said to Angrel.
The Sith know this. Warriors know this.
He fixed a gaze on Adras, and the words came out a snarl.
What mistakes do you mean, Adras? Name them.
Adras ignored the question.
Do you care for her, Malgus?
Love her.
She is a servant, and you are a fool,
Malgus said, his anger rising.
She satisfies my needs when I require it. Nothing more.
Adras smiled as if he'd scored a point.